here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Welcome back to Evening Under Lamplight with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. I'm emailable at rla@momentsunderlamplight.co.uk or lamplight@cambridge105.fm. You are invited to attend as we continue our journey with Dante through hell, this week spending time with Canto 4, which takes place in the first circle of the underworld called Limbo. In most mythic journeys, there is a resting place near the beginning for refreshment before venturing further. We see this in the first Star Wars film, for instance, when Luke and the others have a respite on their long flight in the Millennium Falcon, a free time without threats when Luke can begin to learn some of the Jedi lessons. In Dante's Inferno, this respite occurs here in the fourth canto, just before we descend into the real horrors of hell. There's very little action in Canto 4, but it's a tough part of the Inferno, as the Catholic doctrine will seem puzzling and offensive to many people today. But the doctrine is just the basic framework upon which Dante builds his poem, and the poem, if it's going to have any deep merit, must go deeper than doctrine. Doctrine addresses our intellect. Poetry strikes our imagination. It takes us to the deeper world we all actually share, a world something like what we heard Joseph Campbell describe last time as the location of the hero's journey, the dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms. But wait. Before we move to Dante, there are some other things to attend to. Since we're talking this evening under lamplight about Limbo, I thought we might include a bit of foolery, especially since it enables us, the voice of Philadelphia chauvinism in Cambridge, to share another example of the Philadelphia sound, and this time from Chubby Checker, who in 1962 invited us to do the Limbo Rock.
Every limbo boy and girl all around the limbo world gonna do the limbo rock all around the limbo clock. Jack be limbo, Jack be quick, Jack go on the limbo stick. Stick all around the
Chubby Checker, Limbo Rock. It was a special time for young musicians in Philadelphia in the late 50s, early 60s, with Dick Clark's American Bandstand, based in Philadelphia. And it was Dick Clark who recognized Chubby Checker's talent and gave him his start, and promoted his songs, guaranteeing them national popularity. Chubby Checker's hit The Twist started up a little craze in the early 60s for new dance sensations, as they were called. It all seemed so innocent. All these silly dances that followed the twist, the pony, the fly, the locomotion, the mashed potatoes, the continental, and the limbo. A folk dance from Trinidad, as I understand it, brought to America by Chubby Checker's song. And what kind of dance was it? Well, you had two people holding up a horizontal pole about shoulder high and a queue of dancers formed, each one having to make his or her way under the limbo pole, leaning backwards from the waist without touching the pole. Whoever touched the pole was out. Then they held the pole 6 inches lower, and everyone passed under it again, eliminating several more people. Then 6 inches lower, and again. Remember Chubby Checker calling out, "How low can you go?" And this went on until there was only one person left, the limbo king or queen. Obviously the word limbo here is a corruption of limber, because you needed to be quite limber, flexible in your limbs, to get farther into this dance. Jack be limber, Jack be quick, Jack go under limbo stick. But, well, perhaps it was not, after all, so much a dance as an athletic contest. Or perhaps it was not so much a dance or athletic contest as a legitimized form of voyeurism, as everyone watched the dancers' bodies bent all the way back, the legs spread apart. First you spread your limbo feet, as the song tells us, and you wriggle groin foremost under the pole. Or maybe it was more exhibitionism than voyeurism, though the two go together. But it was sanctioned by that still innocent public culture before the 60s revolution really took off. Here, another limbo song, also coming from the Caribbean. Here's Jimmy Cliff, Sitting in Limbo.
Sitting here in limbo, but I know it won't be long. Sitting here in limbo, like a bird without a song. Well, they're putting up resistance, but I know that my faith will lead me on. Sitting here in limbo, waiting for the dice to roll. Sitting here in limbo, got some time to search my soul. Well, they're putting up resistance, but I know that my faith will lead me on. I don't know where life will lead me, but I know. But all that is past and gone. This little boy is moving on. Sitting here in limbo, waiting for the tide to flow. Sitting here in limbo, knowing that I have to go. Resistance, but I know that my fate will lead me on. I can't say what life will show. heart I hid that love and friendship, but all that is past and gone. This little boy is moving on. Sitting here in limbo, knowing that I have to go. Well, they're putting up resistance, but I know that my faith will lead me on. Sitting in limbo.
Jimmy Cliff, sitting here in limbo, waiting for the tide to turn. They're putting up resistance, but I know my faith will lead me on. Limbo here is some kind of waiting room, a place he has the assurance he will move out from, on to somewhere new and better. The past is gone, and now it's time to move along. That makes this song a great song of hope, especially with Jimmy Cliff's quiet, strong, assured voice. But remember, now making the shift to Dante, and hold on, there's a lot to say here. Remember that the gateway to hell told everyone to abandon all hope once they entered. There's no moving along here, except in mindless circles, as we'll see. Nor is there any faith to lead anyone on, except, of course, for Dante himself. He never sits in limbo. He walks through it and out again. So let's remind ourselves that although limbo in popular discourse usually means just some nowhere place where we wait for some change to happen that will release us to get on with things, in Dante, it is a very specific location in the underworld, showing us some very specific things about the world and about human nature and about ourselves. Okay, first, in Catholic doctrine, limbo is the place you go to after death if you have not been baptized, but only because you had no opportunity to be. Baptism here is the token by which you enter heaven. Without baptism, there's no heaven. So in limbo, we find those infants who have died before they could be baptized. They've done no evil, but they don't have the one qualification necessary to be saved. In another section of limbo are the patriarchs, the Jewish men and women from the time before Christ, who had faith in God and in the coming Messiah, but never had the chance to know this Messiah. But after his crucifixion, the doctrine says, Jesus descended into hell, that is, to the area of limbo, and raised up those faithful Jews who had been waiting for the Messiah and brought them to heaven. This episode is usually called the harrowing of hell, a description that is lost in our modern times when so few people have any idea what a harrow is. It's a tool used in preparing soil for seed time, a kind of powerful rake that sifts the soil. So on the Saturday after the crucifixion, Jesus sifted the souls in hell, grabbed the good ones who had faith, and left the rest. Okay, got it? I told you this was going to be a problematic canto. Heaven, by this scheme, seems to be some kind of exclusive club. If you don't qualify to join, no matter what your excuse, you're out. No heaven for you. Tough luck. Stemming from this us-them view of things come all the many religious wars and persecutions. God hates you, so it's okay for you to suffer, for me to kill you. I'm one of the club, and I get credit for doing these things to you. Now look, If we thought Dante was promoting this doctrine, then who among us would hesitate to throw the book out the window? We would relegate Dante to a moment in cultural history, and that's it. But as I hope you're beginning to see, Dante sees through this. He uses the doctrine as the structure for his afterlife story, but sees the deeper truth in the doctrine, which he passes on to us as poetic myth or mythic poetry. So how does Dante treat this concept of limbo? You will recall that at the end of Canto 3, Dante the Pilgrim had fainted from the strong wind and flash of vermilion light. Canto 4 begins as he wakes up, refreshed, he tells us. He peers around in the darkness and finds himself on the brink of an abyss of suffering, abisso doloroso. Did he cross the river Acheron in Charon's boat? Or was he perhaps whisked across by some other means? Did he faint on the far shore or the near shore? We don't know, but there he is. Virgil now leads him to the first circle of hell, which encircles the abyss. Wait a minute, before we go any further. Let me explain the general shape of hell. In Dante's myth, it takes the form of a huge funnel, a deep, wide, circular hole with a succession of wide ledges around the hole, each one getting smaller as the hole narrows towards the center of the earth. And one of the problems we'll see is how Virgil and Dante move down from one circle to the next. Sometimes it's just by climbing down the rock face, and other times, well, we'll see when we get there. The first circle, on the edge of the abyss, is limbo, coming from the Latin word limbus, meaning edge or boundary. This is the edge of hell. Is it in hell or just outside hell? Does it really matter to you? attend to what goes on here and decide for yourself if you want. And this is Evening Under Lamplight with Robert Louis Abrahamson coming to you from Cambridge 105, attending this evening to Canto 4 of Dante's Inferno. We're just about to enter on the border of hell, that is, limbo. Dante can see nothing. It is a cerco mondo, a blind world. But we're not told whether it is blind to Dante because it's too dark for him to see, or blind because the people there are blind to the truth. But it's true that Dante can't really see where to go, and Virgil has to lead him on. Virgil, throughout the poem, represents our human reasoning powers. We cannot, through our senses, find our way around here, but our reason, our Virgil, can understand this inner world we're exploring. The souls down here have, as we saw last time, lost il ben dell'intelletto, the good of their reason. But Dante still has his reasoning powers, which we can see externalized in the person of Virgil. Although Dante cannot see at this point, he can hear. But he hears no lamentations coming from this spot. All he hears are sighs, vibrating in the air around him, coming from duol senza martiri, grief without torment. These souls are lacking something. They're yearning for something they don't have. This yearning is not painful, but more like a constant sense of uneasiness. I suppose it's maybe like when you're looking over a bridge and your glasses fall into the river. You know you have another pair at home, and you don't really need the glasses right now, but you walk around for the rest of the afternoon knowing that there's something wrong, something missing, and though you yearn for those glasses again, you know you're not going to get them again. That's a trivial example of what it's like for these limbicoli, these inhabitants of limbo, who live senza speme in disio, without hope in longing. These souls are so spacey, suspended, ne trista ne lieta, neither sad nor joyful. Virgil doesn't wait for Dante to ask who these souls are, but is eager to tell Dante right away. This is, after all, the place where Virgil himself resides, and these are his landsmen, his paisani, his homeboys. Virgil is anxious to let Dante know that all these souls did not sin. They did nothing wrong. They have merit, but non basta, not enough. They've not been baptized. We see here the souls of the virtuous pagans, specifically those Greeks and Romans known for their virtue and excellence. There are three Muslims here as well. I'm not going to go into that. There's no time. Our sympathy goes out towards these souls who are excluded from heaven for no fault of their own. But Dante's tough, and he's not going to pander to any sentimental leanings we may have. He is describing a state of the soul, and we'll speak further of this in a minute. In the middle of this limbo world is a castle, in the middle of which is a beautiful green meadow, Dante's version of the Elysian fields from classical mythology, the afterlife that the Greeks and Romans pictured for the virtuous. Here, after death, they are given what they chose, this pleasant place, but lit with only a grey light, and people walk around the area quietly discussing topics like poetry, philosophy, and the other arts and sciences. So that's the doctrine and the depiction in the Inferno. But now, what about the mythic significance? What state of our soul is being illustrated here? This calm but not very exciting world, the air trembling with the sighs of longing, it is, I think, the world of reasonableness. It is the world of rational control. No excessive emotions, no foolishness, no vulnerability, hence the walls around this castle, reason warding off any threat of losing control. There's nothing wrong with understanding the world and trying to control it. That's the job of the intellect. But Dante suggests it's not a very exciting world, and most noticeably it lacks the joy of heaven. And whether or not the limbicoli know it, there is a desire deep within them for letting go of control, and thus they sigh. To go deeper here, we need to distinguish, as the medieval thinkers did, between two kinds of virtue, the cardinal virtues and the theological virtues. The cardinal virtues are those we can recognize and practice purely by our human powers. Our intellect or reason can show them to us, and it was the early Greek philosophers who formulated these, notably Plato and Aristotle. Dante later in this canto calls Aristotle, in a famous phrase, il maestro di color che sanno, the master of those who know. The theological virtues are those that go beyond reason, to the super-rational, some call it the irrational, and they come to us through heavenly inspiration. We could never have guessed that these were virtues without that outside help which we then are invited to assent to. It is only the theological virtues that have the power to transform us, and they are figured in Dante's poem as coming through the sacrament of baptism, bestowing the power to open paradise to the dead souls. The four cardinal virtues are temperance, fortitude, justice, prudence. Temperance is the virtue of keeping our lives in balance, not running to excess, not overdoing things, but practicing a certain amount of restraint in our lives. Fortitude is the virtue of courage, not running away from the difficulties of life, even if we feel afraid, having the strength to endure hardship. Justice is the virtue of understanding the right and proper place for everything and giving everyone his or her proper due, not playing favorites, being impartial in judgment. The fourth cardinal virtue needs a bit more explanation. Prudence has lost almost all of its older meanings and now just conjures up a sense of playing it safe, holding our cards close to our chest, giving nothing away. As usual, it had a much stronger and a much more precise meaning in earlier times. Thomas Aquinas defined prudence as the capacity to look back into the past and forward into the possibilities of the future so we can judge clearly and accurately how to live wisely and correctly in the present life. I was talking about this the other day with Malcolm Guite, who told me about a time he was being filmed for some program about prudence, and when he realized that for the presenter, prudence was nothing more than a kind of timid holding back from life, he decided to illustrate Aquinas' definition by taking the presenter on the back of his motorcycle and then driving slowly when it was appropriate, but speeding up quite a lot and scarily, perhaps, to this presenter, speeding up quite a lot when it was wise and preferable to do so. Malcolm Guite, poet, chaplain, lecturer, and one-time prudent motorcyclist. A life lived according to these virtues will be elegant, orderly, intelligent. Variations on the word honor occur 7 times in this canto. These souls are honorable. We are to admire these virtuous pagans. Seeing them lifts up Dante's heart, and he looks around him with a quiet admiration for all the wonderful figures Virgil points out to him. In fact, Dante is welcomed into the elite group of the greatest of the classical poets, Homer, Ovid, Horace, Lucan, and, of course, Virgil. But there's something lacking here, obviously, since they're not in heaven. Mercedi non basta, perché non eber battesimo, Virgil explains. They have merit, but not enough, because they have not been baptized. Baptized here might be seen as the equivalent to saying they do not have the 3 theological virtues. In other words, they have gone as far as they could on a purely human level. But there is more which they did not reach to. Here's how Dorothy Sayers, the great promoter of Dante in the mid-20th century, here's how she explains it. They could and did choose human virtue, and for that they have their reward. Here again, the souls have what they chose. They enjoy that kind of afterlife which they themselves imagined for the virtuous dead. Their failure lay in not imagining better. They are lost because they had not faith, primarily the Christian faith, but also more generally faith in the nature of things. And then she connects it to the humanist view of things. It is the weakness of humanism to fall short in the imagination of ecstasy. At its best, it is noble, reasonable, and cold, and however optimistic about a balanced happiness in this world, pessimistic about a rapturous eternity. Sometimes wistfully aware that others claim the experience of this positive bliss, the humanist can neither accept it by faith, embrace it by hope, nor abandon himself to it in charity. Dorothy Sayers has led us to the 3 theological virtues there at the end of her passage, faith, hope, and charity, or love, which apparently provide the key for the ecstasy the limbicoli are missing. These virtues do not make sense to human reason. In fact, as St. Paul said, they are foolishness to the Greeks. And the one thing the classical ideal did not include was foolishness, except under strictly controlled special occasions. One of the best definitions of the virtue of hope comes from Václav Havel, the Czech writer, dissident, and statesman. Malcolm Guite, who first introduced me to this definition, says he's pretty sure this was written while Havel was in prison. Hope, Havel says, is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart, not of reason, notice. An orientation of the heart. It transcends the world that is immediately experienced and is anchored somewhere beyond its horizons. You see here that Havel is locating this virtue outside of the natural world, outside rational experience. And here's the point we want to grasp. Hope, he says, is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out. I'll say it again. It's not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out. You see how this doesn't really make logical sense. We have to grasp it by something other than our ego self. Rebecca Solnit says something interesting about hope, too. Hope for me, she says, and here we see how these theological virtues are not just Christian virtues. Hope, for me, just means a Buddhist sense of uncertainty, coming to terms with the fact that we don't know what will happen and that we have to let go of the certainty people seem to love more than hope. The next theological virtue, faith, follows from these senses of hope. It is the trust in what we have hoped, a trust that there is a benevolence beyond what we can perceive right here, beyond even what our reason shows us about things. And lastly, charity, a word that has been completely diluted in our language. We often substitute the word love, though I think compassion sometimes gives a closer sense of this virtue. It's not a passion, it is something we choose. Aquinas called it our friendship towards God, or we might say our friendship towards true reality. As well as that, it's the willingness to put aside the claims of our own egos and consider others first, even including those we don't like and those who are hostile to us. It is, if I may say so, the very opposite of the figure Donald Trump parades around as. Trump, as you know, often uses the word loser as a gesture of complete dismissal of other people. He's a loser. He's a loser. Count the number of times he says that. The virtue charity also uses the word loser, but rushes to embrace and support the loser and the underdog. The last shall come first. We see charity in action, for instance, when a fireman rushes into a burning building to save someone trapped inside, not for self-aggrandizing purposes, not to be noble, but simply because someone else needs help and this fireman is the one who can help. And it is this willingness to let go of the claims of our egos that makes this virtue the key to our transformation. All our doings without charity are nothing worth, as the Collect for Quinquagesima puts it, as it asks for the Spirit to pour into our hearts that most excellent gift of charity, the very bond of peace and of all virtues, without which whosoever liveth is counted dead before thee. After our discussion of the theological virtue of charity, caritas, or loving kindness, we took a break with the Tese chant, Ubi Caritas. Where there is charity and love, God is there. So if you don't like to talk about God, and there are valid reasons why the word is distasteful to many people, you can just speak of this self-transcending love, and you're at the same place. Not so much God is love as love is God. Now, can we understand a little better this predicament of the limbicoli, placed in limbo where there is no pain, but there are sighs of longing? They are longing for divine ecstasy, for the light joyfulness that doesn't mind making a fool of itself. Now, it's true that you can desire something only if you've already experienced it, even a little. And so these souls must have felt some inner desire for this heavenly joy, but the problem is that they couldn't imagine what such a joy would be like. It's more of a failure of imagination than a moral fault. And therefore, on the principle that you can become only what you can imagine becoming, I'll say it again, you can become only what you can imagine becoming, because the limbicoli could not imagine what this joy was, they could not attain it. Greek and Roman literature does contain some images of divine foolery, notably the Bacchanalia, wild drunken revelries under the influence of the god Dionysus or Bacchus. But there was something a little too wild about these celebrations, which brought people to hallucinations rather than to divine visions. During one of these revels, for instance, Agave was so caught up in frenzy that she mistook her son Pentheus, who had no business being there, but that's another story. She mistook her son for a wild animal and literally tore him apart, ripping off his arm and his head, placing his head on a pole and bringing it back to the city before she realized what she had done. Well, if such stories are the only images a culture provides for divine foolishness, you can understand how these Greeks and Romans failed to imagine the ecstasy of taking the leap of faith and letting go into transformation. And because they couldn't imagine what it was that they desired, they could have no hope, just that desire, or as Virgil says, sansa spe me vivemo in desio. We in limbo live in desire without hope. They have this feeling that there's more to life than philosophy, reason, order, but they don't know what it is. Something is happening and you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? And remember that Mr. Jones is one of those rational people who do not know what's there beyond their rational world. He's been with the professors, after all, and they've all liked his looks. Well, now, to bring this all to our own lives, we need examples of the state of the soul represented by this section of the underworld. One avenue is to look at Virgil's own epic, the Aeneid, where we find the central, succinct, and poignant comment, sunt lacrimae rerum, translated loosely as, life is full of tears. That's what life is like in the greatest piece of Roman literature. And all the hero Aeneas can do is endure this sorrow. He's called to travel to Italy and lay the foundations of what will later become the great city of Rome. And to do this, he must abandon his lover Dido, who then commits suicide out of grief, but that too is another story. Aeneas grieves for this loss, but he has the cardinal virtue of fortitude, and he endures this pain nobly. But there's no joy for Aeneas, and no weakness. He is not a hero like many of those in the Arthurian myths who fail and through that failure rise to greater joy. Aeneas' ego self does not die so it can be transformed. It just endures as Aeneas carries out his destiny. And as far as I recall, Aeneas never laughs, and if his eyes glow, it's only in the fierceness of battle, not in joyful delight. Another example. There's a very lovely man I know, an emeritus professor of some renown, who was once asking me about the work I was doing with fairy tales. When I mentioned something about the transformation of Cinderella representing the transformation available to all of us, he stopped me. I don't believe in transformation, he said. And that was that. I wasn't put out, but I couldn't continue with what I was saying. He dismissed it, gently, kindly, but decisively. He's one of the sweetest, gentlest, kindest people I know, but there's a grey sadness pervading him, that grey light that shows us that he is living in Dante's limbo state, with those who parlava rado con voci suavi, who spoke little with a gentle voice. Here's one more example, one of the great little stories from the ancient world, which I'm adapting with a few small changes of my own, just for flavoring. It's about Archimedes, the greatest philosopher and scientist on the island of Sicily. One day the king called in the royal goldsmith and gave him a block of 100% gold to use for making the king an exquisite crown. The crown came back, beautiful and shining, but suddenly the king grew suspicious. Suppose that goldsmith had made the crown with only, say, 75% of the gold, replacing that with a cheaper substance and pocketing 25% of the gold for himself. How to test whether this crown was 100% gold as that original block of gold had been? The obvious thing to do would be to measure the dimensions of the crown and then see if these dimensions matched the dimensions of the original block of gold. But how to measure the irregular shape of a crown? They hadn't invented calculus yet, which is the mathematical tool for such calculations. The king called in Archimedes and explained the problem. "I give you a week to work out the solution," he said, "or it's off with your head." So Archimedes went back and puzzled over this problem. At the end of the week, he was no closer to a solution. But he was brave, the cardinal virtue of fortitude, I suppose, and he prepared to go back to the king and confess his failure. Part of the preparation for a court appearance involved having a nice hot bath, but Archimedes' mind, as we can imagine, was not really paying too much attention, and he filled the bath a little too full. So when he climbed in, the water rose and splashed all over the floor. "Eureka!" he shouted. He had found the answer. A body submerged in water will displace a specific amount of water comparable to its volume. He rushed off, perhaps putting on a robe as he ran, and saved the day and saved his own head. But not, alas, that of the goldsmiths, who was discovered to have adulterated the gold crown. So I tell this story. Here's the application. Archimedes began in the limbo space of reason. He tried all sorts of methods to calculate the volume of the crown. He knew what he desired to find, but he could not imagine it. So there he was on that fateful last day, sansa speme in disio, desiring but without hope. The limbo state. But then, a foolish blunder. He let go of rational thought as he climbed into the bath and the water spilled all over the place. And then he was open to the new revelation, transforming it all from despair to joy. He, at least in this story, had successfully made the transition out of limbo up to a heavenly ecstasy, at least for that day anyway. See the point? Now, it's all very well to live a life based on reason. You can be in control of what's going on. And if your reason is good, you will live an honorable, noble life, content within yourself and helpful to others. But what happens when you come to the limits of reason and encounter the unexplainable? How can Archimedes find the answer by using reason when reason can't give him the answer? How do you proceed when you find yourself surrounded by the meaninglessness and absurdities of life, where we all must find ourselves at one time or another? The 20th century defined this predicament as existentialist angst. And for most existentialists, the response was either Aeneas-like noble endurance or a wry, ironic laughter or sneer, as we see, for instance, in Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. But there's another existentialist response, perhaps first expressed by Kierkegaard, that we can let go and be open to the absurd, inexplicable moment without judging, and then, passing through this mystery, allow ourselves to be transformed, even just a little bit, even for just a few minutes. And this is called the leap of faith. And that brings us back to those theological virtues. Now, we're coming up towards the end. And lastly, I think it's only fair to give ourselves a taste of that kind of heavenly joy we've been talking about, some image for ourselves so that we too can attain to it or recognize those moments when we do attain to it. And I thought, who better than Rumi, again showing us that this is not just a Christian vision. Rumi was a Sufi mystic and poet who lived about two generations before Dante. Let's listen to one of the great translators of Rumi, Coleman Barks. His translations are very loose, as he always admits. As he discusses and then presents Rumi's activity of deep listening in the shared place of inwardness that they call the heart. Barks says that his own, Barks's attempt here, is presumptuous. He is speaking, of course, of the quality of chutzpah, or to be more precise, holy chutzpah, daring to go beyond the rational to the theological virtues, which make no rational sense. My life is nothing if not presumptuous, Barks says. Lord. We're given the story beginning, one night a man was crying, Allah. But when he never had a reply from his longing for Allah, he quit praying. He fell into a confused sleep, where he learned that this longing you express is the return message. The grief you cry out from draws you toward union. Your pure sadness that wants to help is the secret cup. That sense of sadness as a secret cup that we do not just endure, but accept as the path to divine union, shows us how far this is from the limbo spirit. Limbo is the place where we long for something we don't have. Heaven, Rumi tells us, is the place where we realize that the longing itself is our union with our heart's desire. The work of Rumi's community, Barks tells us, was to open the heart and to find out and say the truth and celebrate the glory and indignity of being in a human incarnation. We need to connect, you see, to the indignity as well as to the glory.
The Sufis have been experimenting for the last at least 1,000 years with a form of deep listening to poetry, spoken word, and music, and they do movement too. They call it Sama. And it is meant to take us to that shared place of inwardness that they call the heart. Heraclitus called it fire. John Keats called it soul-making. Nasruddin calls it laughter. The Dalai Lama might call it simplicity or radical innocence. The Zen master Rinzai might call it desolation or silence. And our homemade American mystic Joe Miller called it headquarters. Got to get back to headquarters, to that shared place of inwardness. And I am just presumptuous enough to think that's what we're about tonight. My life is nothing if not presumptuous. Lord. One night, a man was crying, Allah, Allah. One night a man was crying, Allah, Allah. His lips grew sweet with the praising, until a cynic said, so, I have heard you calling out, but have you ever gotten any response? The man had no answer for that. He quit praying and fell into a confused sleep, where he dreamed he saw Hitter, the guide of souls, in a thick green foliage. Why did you stop praising? Because I never heard anything back. This longing you express is the return message. The grief you cry out from draws you toward union. Your pure sadness that wants help is the secret cup. Listen to the moan of a dog for its master. That whining is the connection. There are love dogs no one knows the names of. Give your life to be one of them. One night a man was crying. One night a woman was crying. Allah. 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 These poems were spoken spontaneously 700 years ago by Jalaluddin Rumi as part of the work he was doing with a dervish learning community in Konya, Turkey. The group was exactly the size of this group. And the work of that community was to open the heart. So it's good work. It was also to try to say, to find out and say the truth, and to celebrate the glory and the indignity of being in a human incarnation. So these were the things they were trying for. They used poetry and music and silence and stories and jokes, and they took walks and they tended the orchard and the garden, and they loved to watch the behavior of animals. They saw they read the behavior of animals almost as though it were a scripture. They love dogs, especially. And sometimes the Sufis say there are three ways of approaching the mystery. One is prayer. Another step up from that is meditation, the deep centering. And a step up from that is sobet, or conversation. They say that Rumi's poems can be overheard as a conversation. He says one of his models for what the human psyche is that it's a conversation.
And so ends our conversation for this evening under lamplight. We all have our limbo moments, and I hope this evening's conversation, a one-way conversation, until you write back to me at rla@momentsunderlamplight.co.uk. I hope this conversation helps you recognize those limbo moments in your life and those moments when you are rising out of limbo into something more joyful. Come back next time when we come to the circle of the lustful, and the torments begin. So good night from me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, here on Cambridge 105, and see you later. Pater noster, Pater.